All right. So as you can see from this list, there are 8 visions in the book of Zechariah in the first 6 chapters. And as I point out in that very first sentence, they're like the parables. They're very easy to understand the story. But unlike the parables, some of these are so complicated that no one knows what they mean. And I think I've mentioned to you many times now, when I read 7 different commentaries and they all have a different answer, and about that time I think, Deuteronomy 29:29, I'm not going to guess. Everybody thinks they know. Have you ever met anyone who doesn't know what everything in Revelation is teaching? And yet as you talk to 50 different people, what do you find out?
50 different answers.
So I guess I'm just a fool or an idiot because I've just finally come to the conclusion I don't know what Revelation. I know basically what chapters 2 and 3 are about, and I have a pretty clear idea of what the last few chapters are about. But those bowls and those plagues and all those other things, as far as specific applications, all I know is, and one guy summarized it, he said the book of Revelation means we win. And I thought, okay, that's enough. That's all we really need. What do those bowls mean? Who is it? Is this the destruction of Jerusalem? Is this the fall of Rome? Is this the Pope? I think I have some educated guesses, but where do we go with Deuteronomy 29:29? If you don't know what it means, what should you say?
I don't know what it means.
I don't know. That used to really be a problem to me, but it isn't anymore. The older I get, you know, it's just easier to say that. Because when you stand before God, what are you going to say then? I didn't know what it meant. Especially if he says you taught it wrong. And what does John say about that? If you make any guesses, what happens to you in Revelation 22:18-19? It's just not worth the risk. All right, so some of these, about 3 of them, are really basic, straightforward. There's no question whatsoever. And about 3 of them are so complicated that there really isn't an answer. And then the other ones are kind of in between. And here's an interesting question. Why do you think God would write things, put things in the Bible, and we can't figure out what they mean?
To test us, probably.
Okay, that's one reason. Virgil?
I think it's a way and a means of God to stimulate us to think, to ponder on these things, and to understand. One of the things we can see in these things is the majesty of deity. And it brings it out just clear.
Right.
And that's one of the things that mankind has got to understand. There's nothing higher than God. That's it. And any time that we take and come in at a lower level and set it down at a lower level, we're heading in the wrong direction.
Yeah. And I think that's a big problem, is we try to define it down to where we can understand it. And that can be a big problem. Ray and then Carl.
I was just going to say what Virgil
said. Oh, okay.
Just like Deuteronomy, we don't know. I mean, there are things we don't know. Well, God's, like Virgil said, God is up here with his intellect, and we're down here somewhere.
Right.
So everything, he's higher than us.
Well, and that's right.
And there are just, like you said, just some things we just don't know. Sorry, Charles.
Okay, no, that's okay. Well, Carl beat Charles, so Carl's next. Then Charles.
I didn't hear what Brian said, but it may be to test our faith or build our faith, because if we know how awesome God is, and he has already told us his ways are past finding out. You see, so
right.
And no need of going any further than you can understand.
Exactly.
Okay. And he's given us all things that pertain to life and godliness. We can't understand all things that we need to understand.
Right.
So that's surety.
Okay. And Charles, before you make your comment, let me make this one comment. Does it always have to be about us?
No.
In other words, all these things that were written, are they necessarily all written specifically to us? No. Is it possible that John gave additional explanations of Revelation so those people knew exactly what was coming and we don't? And Zechariah, when he was preaching those visions, is it possible he gave them information they needed that we don't? And so we didn't get it. And so sometimes it's going to be a mystery. In other words, it was not put in there for us. It's kind of like the Old Testament. You remember how the prophets were seeking and searching, and what was it revealed to them?
No.
Not written for you. This isn't for you. So we read those things, and we say, this is simple. They read them, they couldn't understand them. Okay, Charles?
The Bible teaches us that my ways are not your ways. Neither are my thoughts, your thoughts. So the way we think, it's not like the way God is thinking. So there are a lot of things that we think that we may know, and he tells us our thoughts are not his thoughts.
That's right.
So only he knows why he did or why he said what he said. We ought to stick with the basics of what we know about his word. And that's it, not going beyond. You don't want to go too far to the left or to the right, but we stay
right
on that straight and narrow, thinking what we can come up with.
That's right. Okay, so, and again, what we have to realize is that is there a whole other realm that is working that we don't know anything about at all? I mean, there's angels, and there's God, and there's principalities and powers, and we get an inkling or a hint from Ephesians chapter 3 that the gospel was not simply for man and for this creation, because it says through the church what will be made known to these beings in heaven.
Manifold
wisdom of God. So it's very possible. As a matter of fact, I would say it's probable that there's a lot of things in the scriptures where God is giving us little glimpses of what's going on. How are we ever going to put that together? We just don't have enough to do it. And that's why I say that if you think you can answer every question in the scriptures, and if you think that we are not truly knowledgeable Christians unless we have an answer for everything, we're going to be in trouble. I use Deuteronomy 29 a lot when people ask questions that I don't know, because sometimes I don't know them because I haven't gotten there yet, but sometimes I don't know them because there's just no way. And you say, well, how do you know the difference? Well, I guess I don't. George, is that your hand or raised? I can't quite tell. Okay, go ahead.
Sometimes I think, and it's probably very pertinent for these visions here, that like the parables, we want to read too much into them.
Yeah.
Where the answer may be really simple, like the first one I think that you said seems to simply be saying that God has not forgotten Jerusalem. And maybe that's all the message was supposed to be.
Right. But we have so much more to think about, so we're trying to find a deeper meaning. And I'll tell you what, those commentaries, man, they wax eloquent on some of the stuff. You just go, where are they getting this? Did I see a hand up here?
Just real quick. In 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter said that Paul wrote some things that were very difficult. Of course, we could say the Holy Spirit did that. And as a result, some people twist that to their own destruction. So, Peter said there are difficult things in the scriptures.
Right.
So it's up to us to make sure we don't twist them. And as you know, with a lot of these visions and prophecies and symbolic language, people have tried to build entire doctrines around them, whether it's premillennialism or whatever it might be. They just twist them to their own destruction.
Right. Okay, one more, and then we're going to get in the class. Carl?
Okay, you're speaking of different realms. Remember that angel said something about he was over helping another angel
right
to fight? Those are things that we don't even see.
Yeah, they're beyond our comprehension.
Right.
Especially when it says things like, I could just barely do this. Here's Gabriel saying, I could just barely hold this back with Michael's help. And you're going, wait a minute, I thought God... Anyway, as I say, there's just a lot of little clues here and there. And the smartest thing that we can do is trust in the things we fully understand and wait for God to explain the rest. Because it's better to say I don't know than to be wrong. At least that's a conclusion I drew a long time ago. Is that if you don't know, don't try to guess, because the secret things belong to God. All right, so as we go through this, as I say, some of them are real basic, some of them are simple. The stories are pretty simple. We got horses among myrtle trees. We have different colored horses, red, black, and sorrel. Then we have four horns, and they were, although there are some symbolic meanings, generally speaking, the word horn in the scriptures refers to what a bull or a goat has coming out of their head. And so these are the horns. They're not attached to something. Now, were there horns on the edge of the altar? Mm-hmm. So the horns had a very symbolic meaning of power. And then we have these craftsmen or engravers or carpenters who have come to terrify or to punish or to remove the threat of these four horns. And again, that one's pretty simple. And we covered a couple of these last week, so I'm not going to go through them again. But the second one, the first one, I think George hit it on the head. God knows what's going on. He's aware, and he's dealing with it. These two visions, if we've got craftsmen, that we've got the understanding of which nations did what, we got craftsmen to deal with it, then don't worry about it. Now, remember, what's going on right now in Zechariah's day? What haven't they built? What are they struggling with? What is their lack of faith dealing with?
They can't build the temple.
Yeah, they can't build the temple. Matter of fact, didn't Haggai say, not time to build the Lord's house? And what does the Lord say? Is it time for you to dwell in your house? Your house has got a ceiling, and it's paneled, and it's beautiful, and my house just sitting here lying waste. Nothing's been done. And so Haggai and Zechariah's job or responsibility was to get them to build that temple. Well, it wasn't just a lack of, or excuse me, it wasn't just a lack of desire or interest. The lack of faith here was similar to, remember when the 10 spies came out of the promised land? What did they say?
Can't do it.
It can't be done. So what evidently were some of these people saying? Can't be done. Well, that's what that vision, this one about the golden lampstand with the bowl, that's what it's teaching. Not by might, not by power, but by my spirit this is going to be done. So the next one, we have a man walking along with a measuring line, and he's going out to measure Jerusalem. And the teaching is that Jerusalem will be inhabited again, and it will be prosperous again, and that God will be a wall of fire around them. Now, where do we read about the wall of fire? Remember, children of Israel are standing at the Red Sea. Is the Red Sea open yet? Uh-uh. And what's coming up on them?
Pharaoh
and his army. And so what happens?
Fire.
Gets this wall of pillar of fire, and they can't cross. And so then the next one, Joshua is standing before the angel of the Lord with Satan opposing him. And what kind of clothes does he have on?
Defiled.
Just filthy, defiled, stinking, nauseating clothing. Then the next one is the golden lampstand. Now we're all aware of the golden lampstand. How many sticks are coming out of the side? How many total lamps are there? Okay, there's seven. And so each one of those seven has a pipe coming into it. And then there's a bowl that the pipes are coming out of. And what two trees are dripping into this bowl? The olive tree. So this is the vision that he sees. And he says, what does it mean? Well, we'll talk about it in just a few moments. Then we have a flying scroll or flying piece of paper that's 15 feet long and 30 feet wide. And it has two things on it, one on one side and one on the other. Two curses. Again, we'll get to that. But again, pretty simple, straightforward. The third one, we have a woman sitting in a basket with a lead disc on top of it, holding her in. And this is talking about wickedness. And again, this is one of the simple ones that's almost impossible to interpret. And then the last vision is the four chariots pulled by a red, black, white, and sorrel horses. Doesn't say how many. Could be 10, could be 5, could be, well, couldn't be one because they're in the plural. So again, you've got these very simple visions of horses and horns and a measuring line and a high priest with dirty clothes on and a lampstand with pipes going into each lamp to keep them self-filled. And then we have a flying scroll with a curse on it, a woman sitting in a basket, and then finally four chariots pulled by red, black, white, and sorrel horses. Now, if that's all we needed, be real simple. But are visions just to be visions? No, visions are given for a purpose of an explanation. So we spent a little bit of time on this one last week, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. But we have Joshua the high priest, and he's got filthy clothes on. Now, there's two reasons why he would have filthy clothes on. First of all, what happened to the office when Babylon came in and destroyed the Jewish temple? What happened to that office? We read about a high priest anytime in Ezekiel or Daniel. See, the office, I'm sure there was somebody who, you know, the lineage came through, but you don't have a temple, you don't have sacrifices, you're in a foreign land, you can't go back to Jerusalem. What's the high priesthood mean in a period like that?
Nothing.
And so it was defiled, it had fallen down. And so that's representative. But what about Joshua himself? Was he motivating or moving the temple being built? No, he wasn't doing anything. He was like the rest of them. They weren't doing anything. And so he's personally defiled, and his office is defiled. And is Satan going to take lying down the God trying to build this back up again? No, so the devil's there, Satan is there, opposing the angel of the Lord, and who wins? Who gets the clothes taken off? Who gets the new turban put on?
Joshua.
So Satan does not win here. He is opposing, but his opposition is overruled, whatever the opposition is. And again, the best we can come up with is that passage in, I think it's Revelation chapter 12, where Michael and the archangels are going out to war. I'm sorry, Michael and his angels are going out to war against the devil and his angels. Who wins?
The Lord.
Okay. The devil is cast out, and they overcome him because of what? The blood of the Lamb. It's the blood of the Lamb. Remember Jesus saying, I've come to bind the strong man. I've come to take death and Hades away from him. I have the keys of death. I have the keys of Hades. He has no more power. He's been cast down. Woe to the earth, though. Why? Because he's got great wrath, and he knows
his time is limited.
He doesn't have a lot of time. So he's going to do everything he can to thwart God, and we're the pawns. This is the thing we have to understand. God wants us to be with him in heaven. So if the devil wants to thwart him, what's his best way? To keep us out of him. Pawn isn't really the right word. We're the spoils. We're the ones that, this is what God wants. We are the riches of God's inheritance in the saints. And what's the devil want to do? He wants to destroy as many as possible. And that's why, what did Peter say? Be sober, be watchful, your adversary the devil, like a roaring lion. What's he want to do?
Devour.
Why? Because he has a personal animosity against us? Well, possibly, but what's his main goal? To hurt God, to destroy God, to damage God. I think the same thing is true in the Garden of Eden. It wouldn't matter whether it was Adam and Eve or any other people. It wasn't so much that Satan wanted to hurt two people. What did he want to hurt? He wanted to damage God's plan. Did I see him? Go ahead, Carl.
Well, the devil is mighty, but God is almighty. And we have to keep in mind that the only thing the devil has to work on is the saints, because he's got the rest of the world.
Right. Yeah, and that's why we need to be concerned. Be sober is not just, you know, keep your eyes open. There's a tendency of fear and concern there. Do we have any fear? Let us fear lest we fall short. There is no temptation taken you but is common to man, but let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So, yeah, greater is he who is in you than he that is in them is what John says, but the whole book of John is warning us, don't be deceived. Because if you're deceived, you're going to lose everything. All right, so this high priest is cleansed, and then, excuse me, We have an admonition on the top of page 2. And the angel of the Lord is now speaking directly to Joshua. Now, whether this is part of the vision or whether this is real doesn't really make too much difference. If it's not part, or if it's just part of the vision, who's going to let Joshua know about this? Well, Zechariah. That's his responsibility. He's a prophet. So if this is, but you see in verse 6, right in the middle of the page, it says, the angel of the Lord admonished Joshua, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts, if you will walk in my ways and if you will keep my command, then you shall also judge my house and likewise have charge of my courts. And I will give you places to walk among these who stand here. Now, this seems to be a promise of what is in the vision itself. It doesn't seem to me that this is something that because the promise is, I'm going to give you places to walk among those who stand here. So this is a different realm, because the angel of the Lord is and Satan are also involved in this activity. So this is a specific admonition to him. kind of similar. You remember in the book of Ephesians, it says that if we will remain faithful, we'll reign with him. We are reigning with him in heavenly places. Now, do we understand what that heavenly places is? No, because that's where the, remember in Ephesians 6, he says our warfare is against what? A spiritual host of wickedness in
heavenly places.
In heavenly places. So we're sharing a realm that we don't know very much about. Our citizenship is in heaven, and we are living in the heavenly places, and we're reigning with him in the heavenly places. But we're also battling against these people in the heavenly places. So this particular vision, again, it's very interesting. And then he gives us a wondrous sign. And this is where the vision becomes so important to us. And the sign that he gives, and I'm not going to read all of this because our time's getting away, and I do want to finish this tonight, but you can see the word branch is mentioned in four different scriptures here. It's mentioned here, it's mentioned in Isaiah, it's mentioned in Jeremiah, and it's again mentioned in Zechariah. There's no doubt at all this is talking about the Messiah. So this is a wondrous sign. I'm bringing forth my servant, the branch. And again, I'm not going to take a ton of time on this evening, but this is one of those prophecies we were talking about in our sermon a couple of weeks ago. You remember when I said the Old Testament has prophecies in it that are more New Testament than Old Testament? Mm-hmm. And these are among those prophecies. Verse 9, behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon the stone are seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave its inscription, says the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. Now, do we know what that means? When did the Lord remove all iniquity in one day? When Jesus died on the cross, right? All the iniquity was removed in one day. When Jesus ascended back to heaven with that blood, he brought remission of sins, total, complete remission of sins. It happened in one day. And so, again, the next verse, actually all four of these verses, which again I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, we'll come back to this at the very last because it's going to come up again. So let's go ahead and skip over to page 3, and let's talk now about this self-filling lampstand. Excuse me. So we have this beautiful imagery, which I'll read a little bit of. It's the top of page 3. It says, I am looking, and there is a lampstand of solid gold with a bowl on top of it, and on the stand seven lamps with seven pipes to the seven lamps. Two olive trees are by it, one at the right, one at its left. And then, so he says, what are these? And the angel answers him in verse 6 by saying, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. So this vision is a word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. And the vision means not by might, not by power, but my spirit, but by my spirit. So the concept is simple. You remember how often were the Jews to go into the temple and trim the lampstand and put new oil in it? Every day, right? So every day they had to go in there and they had to take care of that lamp, make sure it had the oil, make sure that they would clip the wicks. They had all of these articles that were in the tabernacle and they were supposed to go in and do that. What about this one? Do they need to fill it with oil? No, we don't need human intervention here. That's the purpose, that's the point of this particular vision, is God can do things without human intervention. He doesn't need their help. And that's the vision to Zerubbabel here. I don't need your might. Don't need your power. Now, didn't he tell the spies the same thing? Did God need their help? In the Battle of Jericho, what did God need them for?
No.
They were there, and they did their part, but who did all the work? God did. Same thing with our salvation. How much of our salvation is God's part? About 99.9999%. How much is ours?
Obeying.
Just be faithful until death. But when you think about being faithful until death, is that really very much compared to what God did? So, not by might, not by power, but my spirit. And then verse 7, who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain. Now, many commentators want to make this vision apply to Jesus, but there's no... In any type, it might be the case. But you can't find anything in the scriptures that would justify this, with the exception of who is Jesus' great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather? Zerubbabel. So there is a relation there. And, of course, with David, we find that oftentimes when we think it's talking about David, and it is, but what's it also talking about?
Jesus.
Talking about Jesus. So there's a possibility, but I didn't feel comfortable with it, so I didn't carry it forth. But the basic teaching is in that Zechariah 4, 9, and 10, where it says, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation, he will finish it. Doesn't matter what the adversaries are. I'm going to take care of the adversaries. Any question? Okay, we're going to kind of go quickly through these. They're complicated. Some of them are inscrutable. But I just, you know, it's very seldom that we hit Zechariah. How many times have you studied Zechariah in your life? I think I've taught it twice. I guess I did sit in a class once on it. But it's not a subject that we deal with very often. So I just wanted to touch on these lightly. All right, so now we have the flying scroll. And as I mentioned, it's 30 by 15 feet, and there's two curses. One on the one side is for every thief. All right, every thief, everyone who steals. You see there at the very bottom, this is a curse that goes out over the face of the whole earth. Every thief shall be expelled according to one side. Every perjurer or every false swearer will be expelled according to the other side. Now, why thieving, why stealing and false testimony? I mean, of all the sins, why would he pick these two? Nobody knows. Why is it going out over all the earth? Where's the law? Where's the Jews? Why is this going out over all the earth? And nobody knows. So we have a vision here about the curse that God is going to, and in a sense, do you remember the end of Revelation where it says that all liars are going to be
cast
in the lake of fire? Why did he single out liars? Well, if a sin is a sin is a sin, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter which sin, but that's the specific one that God says. You say, well, why would that be in there? Well, maybe because in John 8:44, who's the father of all lies?
Satan.
In Hebrews chapter 6, what is it impossible for God to do? To lie. So if you tell a lie, you have any affinity to God at all? He can't lie. Who's the father of all lies?
Satan.
So who's your father if you're a liar?
Satan.
Maybe that's what it is. We don't know. And the same thing here. False swearing. Let's face it. Is that a common sin for people to be in the courts? And have you ever done that? Have you ever falsely sworn in a court? I mean, this is a terrible sin. We're all at risk for it, right? No, this isn't something that most of us would ever do. But, yeah, Tim, you're right. It's done a lot. But compared to other sins, how often can a man look at a woman and lust after her? How often can you be in the court being under oath and swear falsely? You see my point? It's kind of a sin that's of a minor, I don't mean minor in the sense of its negative nature, but I mean minor in the sense that how often is this one done?
The opportunities.
Well, yeah, the opportunity's there. But as I say, people try to figure this out, and they give these outlandish answers, and the bottom line is, why did he pick these two? I don't know. Because he picked these two. George?
Those two covered every false thing that goes on in the world, I believe. Every one who claims to be a Christian or to believe in Jesus but doesn't do his will is effectively swearing falsely to the world about him.
Well, and as I say, there's some truth to that, but do we know that's what he's talking about here? I don't disagree with what you're saying. I'm just saying, would you put your sign your name to that and say, this is what this means? See, yeah, and I'm sure that has something to do with it. But like I said, we just have to be careful. Charles and then Carl.
Yeah, you know, along the same lines, too, if you think about it, it's easier to tell a lie than to tell the truth. If you just want to think about situations, you know, depending upon what the situation is, whatever, it just seems like it's easier to do it that way.
Right.
Now, if there's a situation where you know that something is going to happen to you, I mean, you know, you're telling the truth or whatever, you know, it's okay, well, that right there, I think I'll just bypass the truth and I'll just tell that lie to get out of the situation right.
Right.
Now. You know, I've been to a court and listened to people just tell a lie on top of lies. That, you know, and I'm like, wow, I can't believe this. You know, you're talking to a judge right here, people
right.
That are there and they're just lying, you know.
I mean, right. And those are the people that this curse is going to go into their house and burn it down. Let's see, what, Carl?
Well, I was just saying, I grew up in an area in a time when a liar was a bad thing. Those people didn't lie to one another. The times have changed.
Right. Well, hopefully not here. Hopefully not here. Jack, sorry, your name just, I'm in. Like senior moment there.
That's okay. David, Alan, I just got to thinking about Proverbs 6:16-19. The seven things that are an abomination to God. And one of them is lying. And if you think about the other six, somewhere along the line, there's going to be an untruth involved in the action being taken. And like George said, somewhere along the line, there's going to be a lie. A proud look is one of them. Well, obviously, this person is lying to himself by feeling that he's much better than he ought to be. But, lying is really something to be taken very, very seriously because God does hate it.
Right. But let's not lose sight of the fact that this isn't lying. This is swearing falsely in God's name. This is perjury. So it's a little more specific. And I agree with everything that we've all said, but you can't really use this particular verse to condemn lying because this is talking about a specific form of lying. So it's kind of like, thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, is adultery fornication? Well, it's one of them, but are there a lot of fornications that are not adultery? So one's a class, and one's a small subset of the class. And so lying is the class, but swearing falsely, is that a little different than lying? Yeah, it's very different. It's very specific. And as I say, hopefully no one here has ever done that. Now, to say I've never lied is one thing, but to swear falsely in God's name, how many people do you think have done that here? Would you actually do that if somebody said, I'm not sure if you're telling me the truth or not. I want you to swear by God whether you're telling me the truth or not. Would most of us say, well, what am I going to do now? I mean, you can't swear falsely, so you're going to have to admit you lied. That's what I think most of us would do. Virgil?
Yeah, I think that you hit that on the head. It's like Charles was saying there. When you go before a court of law and you raise your right hand, you swear to tell the truth. When you fail to do that, that is something that is very deliberate.
Yes.
It's something that you're not only affecting yourself, you're affecting the health and the welfare and everything of the people that's involved in that thing.
Right.
It goes beyond.
Sure. Plus, who are you invoking?
Yeah.
You're invoking God.
Yes.
And so as I say, it's a very specific situation here. Well, we didn't finish, but I tell you what, there's not much here. You can read it. I don't have much to say about the rest of them. I do want to spend some time on the visions to reality next week because I think that's an important point, but we'll go into that. So we'll pick up next week at the end of chapter 6. And then I think we can quickly go through a lot of interesting messianic prophecies in Zechariah that we'll touch on next week. And then we'll move away from Zechariah. As I said, we're in a Bible character study, but in this particular case, we don't know anything about Zechariah, so we're looking more at some things he says in the book. But we'll move quickly into some of the other books. So, as a matter of fact, Ezra is going to be an interesting character because we learn a lot about him. All right, appreciate your time. Thank you.